Making and Breaking Social Policy, a podcast about how we collectively respond to big social issues and what this means for social and community practice. My name is Ben Lohmeyer, and I'm a lecturer and researcher in social work at Flinders University. Today we have two special guests. The first is Sean Lappin, Managing Director of Connected Self, and the second is a returning special guest, Luke Cantley. So we're going to have a conversation about the Raising the Age of Criminal Responsibility campaign in Australia. So a little bit about Sean first. So as I said, he's the Managing Director of Connected Self. And Connected Self is, well, Sean recently described it as a profit-for-purpose organization. So not a traditional NGO or not-for-profit organization, but in short, any profit goes back into the organization and the service it does to the community. So according to their website, their vision is about assisting young people, adults and families, organizations and our people to be grounded, mindful, inspired and productive by supporting and strengthening their connections with themselves, the connection with their family, community and customers, their connection with to their environment, and their connection to the goals and aspirations and ways to overcome these barriers. So that's a bit about Sean and his organization that he works with and for. And this is Luke, which of course we've had on the podcast before. In fact, I'm pretty sure he was our very first guest. So he only has to do a couple more visits to really cement his place on the podcast. So Luke has family connections to the Gundjamara Nation of Victoria and is a research associate with the Social Work Innovation Research Living Space, or SWIRLS, here at Flinders University. Through his research, Luke seeks to understand the role of Indigenous culture plays in protective factors in the child protection system, whilst also exploring the nuances of between, say, child safety and cultural safety. Luke has gained extensive experience working as an Aboriginal health worker using a strengths-based approach across diverse sectors, including prison health, primary health care, public housing, and mental health services. So we recognise that Flinders Social Work operates on the lands and waters of traditional lands and waters of the Kaurna people, pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. I have special guests with me today. We have Sean Lappin and we have Luke, who has joined us before as well. So Luke Handley, welcome back. Thanks for coming on. I think you've almost reached friend of the podcast status.
Excellent.
I think you need three appearances right to get to that level. So it's great to have you back for number two.
Excellent. Thank you.
And we're going to have a chat about the Raise the Age campaign. And I'm actually going to start off with you, Sean. So you're involved in this national campaign to raise the age of criminal responsibility in Australia. For people who don't know anything about it, can you give us a bit of a quick summary?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, Australia's age of criminal responsibility is really, really low. You know, and if you would compare it to other developed countries, many of them, 14 years of age is the age of criminal responsibility, and for others, it's 12 years of age. And even developing countries recognise that children aren't responsible for the criminal responsibility until they're either 12 or 14. So it's a pretty important issue. I think it impacts a lot on our community, but mostly it takes children away from their attachment figures during critical transitional times, which is why it's so important. And we know that children, the earlier they go to prison, the more likely they are to be involved in much worse crime subsequent to that first visit. And we also know that Aboriginal children and young people are really very overrepresented in the criminal justice system already. And we're seeing a lot of younger Aboriginal children going to prison and again removing them from country and family and community and all that has meaning for them, and we just don't think that's good enough. So a campaign has been led by the Human Rights Law Centre, so Lauren Frost from that organisation, who do fantastic work to lead the charge on trying to influence a raise in the age for legislative criminal responsibility.
Yeah, great. Thanks, mate. So it's pretty simple at its core. It's just saying we think the age of criminal responsibility should be higher than what it is. So it's at 10 years of age across all of Australia?
Yeah, ACT are changing their laws, actually. So ACT are raising the age of criminal responsibility, which is brilliant. Unfortunately, some other jurisdictions are going a little bit backwards, not in terms of raise the age, but how they're treating bail, for example, for young people. So it is a challenge. And the CAG, which is the Council of Australian Governments, and the Attorney General has actually had a review into this and asked for a lot of submissions from a lot of organisations. Then generated a report and have since kind of buried the report. So part of this campaign is trying to go through freedom of information channels to try and get hold at least of some of the submissions because we feel there would have been an overwhelming, perspective around raising the age of criminal responsibility. So... yeah, it's topical. It's really important, and it's time that we shifted, basically.
Yeah, that's great. Mate, you've mentioned a few of the different groups involved. Can you tell us just a little bit about what your role has been in this campaign and Connected Self as well?
I guess they call us that we're one of the national campaign members, but it's something that obviously is completely voluntary, that people become part of because they believe that something needs to change. So at this stage, it's participating in meetings, talking about different strategies. We generally go around the country and hear what's being done in each jurisdiction. And then, yeah, we'll talk about what we think is important, how different states and territories can assist each other. For example, there was a lot of work being done on, so if we were to raise the age, what happens to these children who are involved in offending and risk-taking behaviour? So there was a paper that was developed up and that's being circulated, which is around what are some of the alternatives to detention for those younger children. So that's part of our role as well, is to review that sort of stuff and just to support the process generally.
Yeah, great. I mean, that's a really interesting point as well that you point out there. As soon as we suggest raising the age, there's a fairly obvious question, which is, well, what are we going to do instead? You know, what are some of the alternatives if we're raising the age from 10 years to something closer to 14? What do we do with 10 to 11, 13-year-olds who might be currently or potentially future in that kind of space?
Well, we'd probably get back to the evidence, wouldn't we, and have a look at, you know, what works with those children and young people. Because we know that kids going to detention actually doesn't work. The recidivism rates, so the reoffending rates are really high. And so as an intervention that costs a great deal of money, it's actually actually counterproductive because it often compounds trauma for those kids. So to answer your question, I think you'd go to the evidence and you would look at what sort of things build children and young people's capacity to get better connected to their families, better connected to their communities, have some sort of educational kind of engagement. And there's a bunch of different ideas, obviously, on the table, and a lot of those are about supporting those children to get the healing and the therapeutic input that they need, because obviously things are not going well, right? So that's a lot of what we think should happen. But, you know, some of the things you'd be familiar with, Ben, is the restorative approach. And are there more formal and structured restorative approaches that can be put into play? And I know we've got restorative processes that happen in different jurisdictions, but I don't think they're operating in an optimal way. You know, some of the ones I looked at, for example, in Northern Territory, some of those restorative processes were happening 12 or 18 months after the offence was committed. And if kids are that age, it's like, how do you connect this stuff up? You know, that was a lifetime ago. They were almost, developmentally, they were almost a different human at that time. So it's, it needs to be more responsive. There's models actually overseas, Ben, you might be familiar with. It's restorative reporting centres, I believe, where they've got young people going and checking in. They might be electronically monitored, but they check in, actually run processes, and they get some education around it. There's a bunch of different suggestions and alternatives. And I know the ACT government has actually done a bit of work around this, so there will be a paper circulating that talks about some of those alternatives and costs and effectiveness and all that sort of stuff.
That's great. Thanks, mate. We'll be sure to make the link to that paper as well from the ACT so that people can follow that up if they want to. And it's actually really encouraging to hear that there are alternatives around or parts of our system that are working towards a way that we'd like to do, like a restorative kind of process. And I know South Australia was a bit of a national leader in that sense in terms of embedding restorative processes in the criminal justice system, particularly with young people. So it would be great to see some of those improved. But you mentioned the role of Indigenous voices and Indigenous people in our criminal justice system as well. And I just wanted to come over to Luke for a minute, because some of the strongest voices in this campaign have been Indigenous voices, but people might not necessarily know why this is such a critical issue to Indigenous people. So can you tell us a little bit about that, Luke? Like, why is this such an important issue?
Sure. Thanks, Ben. Great question. I think I'm going to touch on some points that Sean was raising just before. And for people who are following the podcast, they would have heard me talk about some of these points in my first podcast with the model of care and looking at prison health stuff. But we certainly know that the Aboriginal population is overrepresented in the incarceration system. And that is leading on from things from systemic racism and intergenerational trauma and ongoing impacts associated with previous policies around forceful removal of children, stolen generation stuff, and colonization. So these are lasting impacts that families are having today. And something I did discuss with you in the previous podcast is we know that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are being incarcerated for crimes and for offences that non-Indigenous Australians would receive a fine or some sort of diversion program for. So I think that the Indigenous voice in this program or this approach is really appropriate and is really important, because Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children are being criminalised at a younger age. So we're seeing that young children or young people are being approached by systems or by SAPOL or whoever it might be within that authoritarian position, and then putting these systems in place that continue to hold Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people at a disadvantage. And then, as Sean was saying before, that once a child or a young person is incarcerated, an Aboriginal child or young person, and they're removed from country, they're removed from culture, they're removed from their family, that then becomes a problem and sort of exacerbates their situation. And at a younger age, we know that our young fellas are picking up learnings and teachings within an adult system that they wouldn't be exposed to if they had some kind of diversion program, which is unfortunately then leading to behaviours or knowledges that encourage or enforce recidivism. And that's just because of the systems that our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are living in. And so I think doing a bit of reading and a bit of research around sort of the topic before we come in today, I had a bit of a look and certainly come across the stuff that we're talking about doing now in ACT. But following some of the work that Anne Hollands has been talking about, who's the National Children's Commissioner, she was sort of saying that incarcerating Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people or children and young people at the age of 10 is just a shortcoming in public policy. Basically, at this age, we should be wrapping care and love around our children and young people and not incarcerating them.
Thanks, mate. Yeah. That's great. I mean, I think it's just really clear that this kind of outcome, that incarcerating young people, is just it's a policy decision, right? Like, we could make a different decision. It's not that the problem couldn't be solved in another way.
Absolutely.
And so that's something we're consciously doing, I suppose. And when you lay out some of the impacts like that, especially when you kind of look at the cycles as well, like you talked about, Aboriginal young people are getting arrested for things that they wouldn't, like a wife, young person wouldn't, mm-hmm. And then they go into a system which then compounds that process.
Absolutely.
You can just see it have circles of sort of disadvantage in that.
And absolutely. And if you have a look at some of the things that are in place for 60,000 years, we're talking about a cultural system where elders have passed on knowledge and wisdom to the younger generation, and they've learned and grown over time. And now that's being fractured by a colonial system, which is an incarceration system, which is predominantly a white-based system. which doesn't necessarily sort of fit into the process for Aboriginal children and young people to grow and potentially learn the right way, or, you know, instead of being around community and the important figures in their life and potentially learning a different way, or, you know, a diversion or something, they're being put into systems that are detrimental.
I almost want to... Sorry, you go, Sean.
No, I absolutely agree, Luke. I think it's... It's really difficult when you see it operating like it is, because it's almost like we're corralling these kids into these very tertiary kind of systems that they get wrapped up in. The whole idea that the white system has come in over the top and fractured the LORE part of law, Aboriginal law, to the degree that they then don't feel equipped to be able to manage what's going on for young people. For example, we went out to some of the lands when we're doing some work around a diversion program evaluation, and going into the community and you know, the old people, they consistently held their hands up together and they basically said, all we want is two-way communication that's on the same level. That's all we want. So because we want to know what we should be doing, but we also have all of this amazing wisdom and understanding that we can bring to this that will help you better understand it. But instead of that, we're just kind of pulling these kids out of community. And other kind of policy decisions, like the intervention, for example, started to break down a lot of the way that some of that community response to challenging behaviours. And because that was kind of taken away, then there was this just nothingness that was there, and people didn't feel confident about what they should be doing. This is the story that we were being told. So it's almost like you've taken that opportunity away to really implement law as it has been implemented for such a long time, and you've put in place a system that all it does is it basically fractures kids' relationships with critical people in the community. So
yeah, and that compounds trauma, and then that continues to be quite a cyclic nature that becomes into their adulthood, and then if they become parents, that then manifests onto their children, and it just becomes this continuous cycle. Absolutely.
I almost want to get you to go back and explain the model of care that we talked about previously, just because for me that really highlights the way the system does fragment and disconnect in really tangible ways. But we won't, because, you know, we've got a podcast.
The podcast is there, absolutely.
So you can just go listen to that.
Absolutely.
That's fine. Sean, you mentioned that you've been doing some work around an evaluation in the Northern Territory. I think it's of the Youth Outreach and Re-engagement Team. Can you tell us just a little bit about this project?
Yeah, I can. So it was designed as a diversionary strategy, but unfortunately it didn't have much of the community voice in its development, which meant that it wasn't all that well kind of accepted or maybe implemented in the initial stages. Effectively, it was trying to provide a case management kind of and some more practical supports, while also making sure the kids would get to court, and with the notion of trying to intervene sort of earlier. I think the challenge here is that, you know, I think some of the fundamental challenge in all of this is what you mentioned before, Luke, which is the trauma of colonisation. You know, these people were representing territory families and were trying to go into communities, and because of the historical notion of, you know, the stolen generation, etc., and the lack of healing that has occurred there, it's a very, very challenging relationship. So it's very difficult for these people to get trust in those communities, and it's absolutely reasonable that those communities struggle with trust, because there just hasn't been a process that's allowed that healing to kind of occur. So, yeah, fundamentally, I think that's a challenge. But the other thing that we was reinforced over and over and over again by community is that we need to be part of the solution. Instead of kind of templating these approaches onto communities, that going into communities and kind of working with them, same level, side by side, two-way learning, we can establish processes that will help keep our kids in community and keep them safe and well and with the people that they love and who love them, obviously.
I was having a bit of a read of the executive summary bit of your document and hadn't got a chance to read through the rest of it just yet. But one of the key principles that you talked about in there for preparing or improving this program was self-determination. So you talked about the need to transition outreach and engagement work to Aboriginal-controlled organisations. I'm wondering if you can speak to that just a little bit more for us. Why is that such a critical point?
Well, I think it's that notion that I just discussed, which is allowing Aboriginal people to bring their understanding of family and community and the local culture and law to the discussion so that the solution can be customised to the community. Like, it makes perfect sense when we're talking about it like this, but for some reason it translates like this. It always seems to be that we think we can create these programs in kind of reasonably sort of isolated government agencies and potentially just, again, template them out to communities. ACOs or Aboriginal community controlled organisations are best placed to be connected to community. And so they're the probably the most appropriate agency to shape what the approach should be. And there's so many opportunities for this stuff. I often think that it's not for lack of resourcing in lots of ways, but it's often all of these different fragmented, often case management programs that are implemented and sort of overlay each other in complicated ways, in ways that most Aboriginal families don't even really understand, that just don't have impact. Instead of being able to go, this is an opportunity for community to shape an approach that's going to work for them.
Makes sense. Look, I'm just thinking about some of the work that you've been doing at the moment, and particularly you've been going and running some yarning circles with some different organisations about Aboriginal young people in child protection.
Correct.
And I'm wondering if there's some overlap here that we need to kind of be aware of. Is there any messages starting to come through your yarning circles, the connection again kind of between the child protection system and the juvenile justice system? What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. There's several synergies or connections that I can sort of think that I'm seeing in our yarning circles. Probably the biggest comment I'll make is what Sean was talking about just then, was about the self-determination stuff, that yarning circles bring Aboriginal voice, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice to the research study. So my role is to facilitate the research, and you know, it's up to, or for whatever Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people want to share with me is what we'll get. And that is the voice that leads the process, or which will build services. So, or programs. So if you're trying to bring something into a community, or you're trying to build something and you don't have community buy-in, it's never going to take off because it's not led by what their needs and what their wants are. So I think I was just sort of digressing back to Sean's last comment there. But the yarning circle stuff at the moment around the child protection process for Aboriginal children and young people, predominantly looking at safety and well-being, I think one of the biggest factors that I can take from our yarning circles is the continued conversation around trauma and intergenerational impacts from colonisation. And so that is leading on to the overrepresentation within the child protection system. We know that children are being, again, same for being incarcerated for different reasons. Children, Aboriginal children are being removed, you know, for completely different reasons. And that's to do with systemic racism, that's to do with family trauma, that's some of that sort of that cyclic nature stuff that we've been talking about. And all of this can build into, you know, how a person is, you know, reacting, how they're responding. And if you're a 10-year-old child and you've potentially had an out-of-home care placement, or you've got parents who have been incarcerated, or there's all these external factors that are weighing down on who you are, and you haven't developed any of that sort of the capacity in your thinking, or, you know, you don't have any real understanding of who you are or what this means yet, you know, of course you're going to, you know, lash out, or you're going to do something that, you know, the rest of us might think that's probably not appropriate. And unfortunately, if it's a big enough event, you know, you might, you know, receive some kind of punishment, which could be incarceration. And so it really all just ties back to, what we're doing in the community. I couldn't agree more that the Aboriginal community controlled organisation sector should be funded heavily, because Aboriginal people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people know the business and know what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people need. So I'll forever go and listen to what anybody has to say, and, you know, see which one, let them guide what we're doing, because nobody knows better than themselves or what they need to flourish and to be healthy and, you know, successful. And that can also be as a family, what you need to have is your family to come together. So if the family is together, as opposed to being fragmented in incarceration and the child protection system, then, you know, the family itself is a protective factor and will raise their own children in the appropriate and safe manner. And, you know, they want to see their children self-determine, and ultimately that family will self-determine, which will see the entire family then thrive and not have to have ongoing, you know, contact with these systems into the future.
It's a really good point, Luke, because I think when we talk about funding ACCOs, I also think some of it is around the structural barriers that come with the funding. So the funding can be very piecemeal. So the situation that you described with a child and a family and it being a protective factor and all that sort of stuff is really critical. But if you've got this little bit of skinny funding for your family preservation program, for example, this little bit of funding for your youth justice program, and every time you do something, you have to refer, you know, across rather than being able to, I guess, go to the ACCOs and say, from a governance perspective, this is the outcomes that we're looking for. These are some of the indicators that we're kind of chasing. But you guys get to...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
...starts around designing it, but you get to have a really heavy say in it so that we don't put these, you know, I guess funding silos in the way of doing good work that is child-centered and family-centric.
Yeah, for sure. I've always said that KPIs don't work in Aboriginal business, so because it's never been set up that way. So... for the longest of times, I've always thought we need bipartisan support and isolated funding from both governments. So, you know, the majority of processes that we're trying to work towards always works on this four-year funding. So, you know, we're going to try and get something up, but then the government changes and they're not going to support that, or they want to have a look. So you need ongoing support plus beyond this four-year cycle, you know, to support the Aboriginal community controlled organisations and say, look, in 10 years time, you know, we need to see these things, you know, in the Closing the Gap campaign, or we want to see this in whatever the system is. However you do your business is up to you. We'll come and see you at that point. And that'll be the most successful way that we'll see things like Raising the Age campaign will get through, the reduction recidivism, you know, child protection numbers will come down, because Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people will be given the funding and the resources and the means to take care of their own business.
Yeah, that's amazing. One of the things that keeps coming to mind is, as you're both talking, the key part of the drive behind this podcast and the subject that it's linked to is recognizing that the way we respond to social issues through social policy starts by how we imagine what the problem is. And if we start with what we've got at the moment is a system, a criminal justice system that comes from a colonial legacy that is set up around punitive responses to a certain way of understanding law, right? Yeah. But what you've both been describing is a reimagining of that problem, or maybe another way to put it is different inputs of different ideas and knowledge on what the problem could be thought about as. So like, who should have a voice? And that creates a different kind of problem. You know, how should that be funded, or who's whether we're looking at it as something that needs to be fixed through punitive responses, or if we're looking at something that needs to be fixed through restorative healing kind of responses. And so what I love about listening to this conversation is listening to you talk about this issue of criminal responsibility in a whole new way. It just paints a new picture, and new things are possible, new ways of thinking are possible, because we start with those conversations.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So the other part to this this topic, and many ways this podcast as well, because it's called Making and Breaking Social Policy. So we've talked a bit about kind of the making of it, or, you know, the way we set it up. Let's talk a little bit about the breaking of it, because part of what we're here to talk about is a social policy campaign, right? So we want to see some change. So it's a massive issue, but Sean, I want to ask you a little bit about the campaign itself, if that makes sense, as separate from the issue. So what makes an effective campaign around this sort of stuff? Like, how do we go about creating that change through a national campaign?
I think when you've got agencies that can provide the lead coordination, like that have a pretty darn good reputation, like the Human Rights Law Centre, you've got a good starting point, because this stuff doesn't happen by osmosis, right? Like, there's a bit of energy that goes into this, and there's certainly a lot of time. So Lauren Frost, who's been leading the campaign, has just been doing a brilliant job. And the way that she engages people from a whole range of different agencies across all the different jurisdictions is great. So I think that that's a really, really good starting point. And she does periodic check-ins with people, you know, for these national video meetings that we have. I think the second one is looking at what the levers are. Like, you know, there's obviously political levers here, but sometimes it's not obvious which one needs to be pulled and how you even, you know, should pull that lever. So, you know, one of the very clever things that the Raise the Age campaign did was jumped on the back of the Human Rights Council working group on the Universal Periodic Review. So basically what this means is the United Nations General Assembly do these reviews. So this is, I think, Australia's third review. So they're up to the 37th session. There's a whole bunch of different countries, members of the General Assembly come together. And I've got a bit of a summary. This one comes from the Save the Children, but having, and I think they did a really good job of the way they engaged in the process, or the way we, I guess, collectively, but all those much more clever people than I, who managed to get the ear of some of these delegates. And the highlight is that from 30 recommendations to raise Australia's minimal age of criminal responsibility. So that's the single most made specific recommendation to Australia. So that's great, isn't it? So what you're effectively getting is a global audience, and you're getting a whole lot of currency around a pretty important topic. So that work was really good. The work they're doing under the Freedom of Information, even though they've made it such a challenging process, where they got back by the latest part of the deadline and then basically said, we don't have enough resources to give you what you need because we have to redact a lot of stuff, etc. So it ended up just getting protracted again. So, but anyway, the strategy is still there. Having public statements that go out that agencies become signatories for. So all of that stuff becomes ways to, I guess, encourage political action around this. I think the one that we haven't gotten, and Northern Territory comes to mind, because things can get the public opinion is quite strong around these issues up in the territory, in both central and in the top end, is the more public campaign. And I think at some point we need to do this, but it's just such a challenging dialogue to have in the public domain. Even though, you know, there's so much research and evidence that tells us that what we're doing is ridiculous, but there's such a strong push, and I'm thinking of some of these vigilante Facebook, you know, groups and stuff in the territory that have such a strong view that all they want is to go hard on youth crime, and for some reason they've got it stuck in their head that being hard means that you'll stop the problem, but it just makes it worse. So it's that frustration when you know that that's a really strong driver in a place like the Territory, but it's really hard to get the, I guess, the necessary audience in a way that will allow good enough dialogue to occur to start to shift some of that public opinion. So yeah, there's a challenge right at the end. I don't know if you've got an idea around that, Luke, but that seems to me to be a pretty tough one.
Yeah, it's definitely it's not something I could probably sum up in a 45-minute podcast. But I think whilst you were sort of just talking away then, the thought that I had was, you know, that two-way learning
you know, you come in partnership, you know, talking about having a shared future together. So every sort of system that I've worked in across my practice-based career and in research sort of says if you can get things right for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population, which is a very, you know, vulnerable, is a targeted population, the learnings and the outcomes from that will work across the board for everybody. So I think it'd be about a process of coming together in the future to learn together for everyone. But at this stage, we're still in a space where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and young people still need to come a long way forward to walk on that shared space.
Yeah, you do, right. And I think the other challenge is because that trauma has is still live, it's still so active, it's really hard to support people to have a voice in a way that gets listened to in some of those institutions. So, yeah, it's, I mean, it's just such a, it's such a complicated issue. But, yeah, the two-way learning is something that I'm definitely really committed to as an ally. I want to be that ally that's able to sit to the side and hopefully amplify the voice of Aboriginal people, but be willing to learn more than I want to add to the discussion as well. But, yeah, it's you're right. It's got a little way to go, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm just thinking, as you're talking, Sean, this issue, like you described, is it seems like a no-brainer. Like it's an obvious thing to change. It's a real choice that we can make. How do you keep working in this sort of space, or what do you enjoy about this sort of space, given that challenge, that fairly, you know, roadblock kind of experience that we seem to be having? You named a couple of different activities that are happening but aren't necessarily getting a response. So what do you enjoy about working in this social policy space? How do you maintain your energy to run a campaign like this, to be involved in a campaign like this?
That's a really good question, Ben. Thank you.
Put you on the spot. Sorry about that.
Well, I think when I get to it, it does feel like you're pushing stuff uphill a lot of the time. So it's definitely not, I guess a role that gives you a lot back, at least immediately. So I think it just comes from this deep-seated value that says we have got to do better around how we work with children and young people and families and communities, and in particular how we work with Aboriginal children and families and communities, given the historical impacts associated with colonisation. So, yeah, I honestly think it comes from that passion. It definitely doesn't come from the fact that you're getting lots of little rewards on the way that make it interesting. Although, you know, some of the strategy stuff is quite fascinating. Like I found the dynamic around how the UN kind of comes into this and the timing of that worked. And there was there was this nice little window to really put an emphasis on this topic. So, yeah, that part of it is definitely enjoyable.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for letting me put you on the spot with that. Before we let you go, because we really enjoyed this conversation, I really appreciate your time. Is there anything that you want to promote that yourself or connect yourself are up to? Is there anything you're working on at the moment that's really interesting?
Yeah, I was talking to Luke before and yourself around the DHS work. I guess, you know, our hope is the earlier we can intervene, the better it's going to be for everybody. I mean, the research just tells us that in quite a stark way. So this gives us an opportunity to look at how do we be responsive to trauma within the systems that are set up to try and support people. Because for too many, and I'm probably going to go back to Aboriginal children and families, their experience is one of often being re-traumatised by the way that they're sort of treated within those systems. So how do we set up that accountability, not just with practitioners and families, but with leaders of organisations, with funding bodies, with everybody that has a responsibility around those organisations. So that's some really cool work we're doing with a woman called Dana Shen, who's done some fabulous work within the local community. Elizabeth Close, who's a brilliant Aboriginal artist, who's helped us to describe some of this stuff in the artistic work that she has created, and in doing it with communities and those that have got lived experience of working and being within the system. That work's very exciting. So I'm very pleased to share a word on that.
That's great. Thanks, mate. If people want to stalk you on the internet and find out some more about these projects, where should they go?
Obviously, our website, so www.connectedself.com.au, but you could get me on email as well, probably, or it's going to be easier to tell you, info@connectedself.com.au, and that'll make its way through to me or someone else who will be able to help you. But our goal is we want people to just feel more connected, because when we feel more connected, we feel safer, and we help people to feel more connected to the, you know, this beautiful country that we're on, as well as within their families and communities, by helping them, achieve their goals and reach their, get the therapeutic input that they need to heal. That's what we're passionate about.
Brilliant. And Luke, any updates since last time we spoke on the stuff you're working on?
I'm cracking away with a paper at the moment, so I think I might get my Friends of the Podcast status, and I might be able to come back and discuss that.
Yes, definitely.
That's certainly looking at some, the safety and well-being of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and young people in the system, in the child protection system. So we'll come back and have a bit of a chat about that. And we're just sort of plugging. As I said, I'm in a really privileged position to be able to just sit and listen and hear Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice around what it means for them and what they need, and what's happening in the community, and just really just get to sit in a space and see how does this line up with policy, or what can we do to make that line up. And it's just a really cool space for me at the moment.
That's awesome. Thanks, man. Yeah, definitely. I'm looking forward to you coming back.
Number three.
Doing number three. That'd be so good.
Cool.
Make sure you hook me up for that one. I just want to have a final plug that if this topic means something to you, hit up the campaign, but also your local members and get it over social media, get it out there, because every day that a child spends in incarceration is a day that they don't get to spend with the people who want to love and protect them. So let's get this legislation changed.
That's perfect. Thanks, mate. We'll be sure to put a few links on the description as well, so people can find some of that information easily. Thanks again, guys. I really enjoyed this conversation. Appreciate your time.
It was really good fun. Thank you, mate.
Thanks, mate.
This episode was edited by Ryan Manheyer, music by Anthem of Rain, sourced from the freemusicarchive.org. You can find me, Ben, on Twitter @LohmeyerBen. If you like the podcast, please like, share, comment, and do all the things.